Okay, good evening, everyone. I want to thank everyone for participating in this year's series, both online and certainly live. The American Jewish Experience is sponsored by Becky Navi Katz, Le'il Nishmat Yona Ben, Harav Aryeh Leib, Zichron Levracha, and I thank Becky and Avi for sponsoring my series again this year. Part 6, Politics and Religion. This is the finale of the series, and I have to confess that this particular lecture has been the most difficult and disappointing to prepare. That is because in all the other areas, we saw expressions of Jewish genius, unique contributions to American life, in many cases, transformative individuals, groups, events, ideas. But when it comes to politics and religion, which after all, Judaism was founded to influence and designated to mold for the benefit of mankind, Jews have played a minor role and very often an unhelpful, even un-Jewish role. And it has been distressing to observe. After all, what is religion but a set of beliefs concerning the cause, nature, and purpose of the universe, which often contains a moral code of behavior? And what is politics but a set of ideas as to how to establish a form of government, how to administer civil society, how the polity, the state, is to be organized for the benefit of the citizenry? So the Torah and the Tariag Mitzvot and the seven Mitzvah B'nai Noach, the seven Noachide laws, are intended for just that purpose, to provide guidance as to the purposes of life and the form and objectives of government that will enable and sustain civil society. And yet we haven't done it. Have we as Jews ever sought not to impose, but even just to publicize the ideas of Torah, such as they pertain to life and liberty? The pursuit of happiness was never a Torah objective. Have we ever sought to educate society as to the best way to live as individuals under God and as a society? In America, the answer is no. So in the two areas where we had the most to say, we've basically said the least and relegated our influence to culture and entertainment, fashion, business, law, etc. That too, as we have seen, is part of Yeshiva Olam, but not its essence. Its essence, to paraphrase the Ramchal at the beginning of Mesil Yesharim, is to ascertain ma chovateinu ba'olamo, what are our obligations in his world. So our obligation is not to make everyone a Jew, but it is to make everyone aware of God's existence and his moral code for all mankind. And in that regard, suffice it to say there's work to do. So how did it come about that Jews should have so little influence in these areas that are obviously in our wheelhouse? What went wrong? What could we have done better? It's not as if the nation was inherently averse to it. The notion of a Judeo-Christian ethic, that term, arose already in the 19th century. But how much Judeo there is in the Judeo-Christian ethic is a question, which, mind you, is not at all identical. Jewish ethics and Christian ethics have a lot of overlap. They converge in many basic areas, but they're not quite the same. So to give an illustration of the effect that we didn't have, consider this vignette from a book called The Chosen Wars by Stephen Weissman, who was for many decades a reporter for the New York Times. It's a history of the Jews in America and how American Jews really became established in the current form they are today. So he cites Arnold Eisen, who was the chancellor of the Jewish Theological Seminary, in a historical book. And Eisen tells the following story. He says, in 1817, an itinerant peddler named Joseph Jonas became one of the first Jews to travel west of the Alleghenies. Jews in colonial times, in the early for a half century of the United States, they lived mainly on the coast, on the East Coast, Charleston, New York, Philadelphia, Boston, etc. Anyway, so Jonas travels in 1817, first Jew west of the Alleghenies, and a Quaker woman was excited to meet him. "Art thou a Jew?" she asked with wonder. "Thou art one of God's chosen people." And after a short time, she expressed disappointment. "Well, thou art no different to other people." It says something. In the realms of politics and religion, we have been more influenced than influencers. And that has been the cause and the effect, especially in the last half century, but even before, of rampant assimilation and intermarriage and the forced redefinition of Jewish status by reform, accepting patrilineal descent, and widespread, almost breathtaking ignorance of Torah. It's a cliche, but unfortunately true, that most American Jews assume that the New York Times editorial page is an accurate distillation of what the Torah seeks of us and says on any topic, and assume as well that the Democratic Party platform originated at Sinai uncannily mirrors the Torah and must therefore be fully embraced. So where have we influenced American religion and politics? And where did American Jews as an entity go wrong? Could it have been different? How can it be different? So go back to the early years, and I suggest four reasons for this limited influence, and there's surely others as well. The first is the lack of cohesiveness of the Jewish community that has always characterized American Jewish life. The second is the focus on physical survival, the exclusion of almost everything else. The third is the staggering ignorance of Torah. And the fourth is democracy and how democracy interplayed with Jewish life. And all four played a role since the very beginning. So briefly, the first Jews came to America in 1654, 23 Sephardim, refugees from Recife, Brazil, to which Portuguese Jews had fled to escape the Inquisition in Europe and subsequent predations in Brazil. They left. They didn't receive such a warm welcome in New York. In fact, Peter Stuyvesant originally banned Jews from settling in New Amsterdam, later New York, calling Jews, I quote, "a deceitful race whose abominable religion worship the feet of mammon." Two centuries later, Karl Marx would lodge similar accusations. Others still do today. Stuyvesant added that we're a hateful people and blasphemous as well. He tried to expel all the Jews. Jews only got to stay because they, and especially their brethren in Europe, appealed to the West India Company that was underwriting Stuyvesant's adventure. And as it turns out, some of their biggest investors were Jews. So Stuyvesant's Jews stayed, and within two decades, founded in Lower Manhattan, She'erith Israel, the oldest synagogue in America, today the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue, whose spiritual leader is an Ashkenazi named Soloveitchik, only in America. Ashkenazim started to arrive in the 1700s, such that by 1720, Ashkenazim were a majority already in New York. Even as Sephardim remained a majority in America. But there's little interaction between the two groups, often to the consternation of the Gentiles. Communal life was different. The davening was different. But the early settlers at least tried to some extent to set up a Jewish establishment, kosher food, shuls, burial societies, even quasi-schools that were more learning programs. It was not easy, and this was really new soil that was being tilled. America was a land of religious freedom, but Christians, almost then all Protestants, did not really understand why Jews didn't eat with them, or why Jewish businesses were closed on Shabbat. And note, that was common, whether a Jew was otherwise observant, it was just known that Jews would not work on Shabbat and keep kosher to the extent they could. One pressure that existed from the very beginning was the pressure to assimilate. In colonial times, the intermarriage rate was about 15%, which remained consistent until the early 1970s. And Jews who intermarried were largely ostracized by other Jews. And it did happen. For example, Judah Monis became the first Jew to graduate college in America, naturally Harvard, 1720. But he converted 2 years later to marry a Gentile woman and to get the job of his choice. In America, Jews were an exotic breed, small in number. But unlike Europe, they could find acceptance as Jews. So Jews fought in the revolution. Some, to be sure, were loyalists to the British, especially New York Jews. New York was a hotbed of loyalists. The loyalists eventually had to flee to Canada, back to England. One well-known exception was Gershon Mendez Seixas, who was known as the first real spiritual leader of Jews in the United States. Although he was not a rabbi, he was the Parnassan Chazan of She'erith Israel. So he actually fled the British. He took all the Klei Kodesh with him, literally sealing the door of the shul in the face of the British, and he fled to Connecticut. I think he wound up in Philadelphia eventually. Another very famous person, Chaim Salomon, was one of the financiers of the revolution. So he was born in Poland to a Sephardic family in 1740, came to New York in 1775. After a stint in a British prison, he used his profession as a business broker to secure loans for the Continental Army. The money he raised, and add to that a lot of money, was donated by himself, was instrumental in funding the climactic Battle of Yorktown, after which the British surrendered. And yet he never sought repayment from the Continental Congress. In fact, he died penniless in 1785. So how accepted were Jews? Well, at the celebration of the completion of the United States Constitution in Philadelphia in 1787, there was a table of kosher food that was set up for the Jews to partake of. Now, this has always been a mixed bag. I remember the signing of the Camp David Accords. This was March 1979. The kosher food table at the White House went almost untouched as Israeli reporters unfortunately devoured the tray food. I've been at several Hanukkah parties at the White House. I could follow the progression. At the Bush Hanukkah party, there was a full table of kosher food, but most tables were not kosher. At the Trump Hanukkah party, everything was kosher, catered by Chabad. I'd be curious to know if the Biden White House reverted to old norms and served non-kosher food as well. I couldn't go. My invitation must have gotten lost in the mail. In any event, Jews' acceptance was formalized, in a sense, in the early years through George Washington's letter to the Touro Synagogue in August 1790, whose president, Moshe Mendez Seixas, the brother of Gershom, sent him a letter of appreciation when he visited Newport. So he didn't come to the shul, but he wrote these words that really shaped American history and defined the status of Jews. Washington wrote, "The citizens of the United States have a right to applaud themselves for having given to mankind examples of an enlarged and liberal policy, a policy worthy of imitation. All possess alike liberty of conscience and immunities of citizenship. It is now no more that toleration is spoken of, as if it was by the indulgence of one class of people that another enjoy the exercise of their inherent natural rights. For happily, the government of the United States gives to bigotry no sanction, to persecution no assistance. May the children of the stock of Abraham, who dwell in this land, continue to merit and enjoy the goodwill of the other inhabitants, while everyone shall sit in safety under his own vine and fig tree, and there shall be none to make him afraid. May the Father of all mercies scatter light and not darkness in our paths, and make us all in our several vocations useful here, and in his own due time and way, everlastingly happy. That was Washington. This was an acknowledgement that Jews were not in the United States to be tolerated, but to be accepted as full citizens. So obviously in Jewish history, then 17 centuries, this was unprecedented and quite welcome. And it might also have contributed to a desire to keep Judaism and religion out of the public sphere, basking in the basic freedom of worship that was enshrined in the First Amendment to the Constitution, the first of the Bill of Rights. So you know the expression, wall of separation of church and state, is not found in the Constitution. It's in a letter written by years later by Thomas Jefferson. And yet America was not meant to be a country free of religion or religious influence on life. What was prohibited is what the First Amendment stated. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Meaning there'll be no official state religion, which is something unique in the world, such as existed in Europe, and no unreasonable limitation on worship, on free exercise of religion. But Jews, we'll come back to this, especially in the 20th century, embrace with gusto this notion of the wall of separation of church and state, and the results have not been pretty. Jews are now in the forefront of the freedom from religion movement, the making of America into a secular progressive state. The results are apparent, but was never meant to be that. There was one enduring consequence of the Jewish experience in the early years, ironic in retrospect. It was the acceptance of Jews, such as it was, that made the acceptance of Catholics possible later in the 19th century, which, given the hostility of Protestants and Catholics, was not obvious. So while this was happening, in religious matters, Jews took a back seat, preferring just to preserve our own freedom of worship, mindful of their primary goal of acceptance, and especially considering the lack of Torah knowledge. And this is something quite astounding in retrospect. The first rabbis did not arrive on American soil until the 1840s, meaning that 200 years of residence passed without true religious leadership. Now, some might consider this a blessing. In fact, it empowered ignoramuses to rule on questions of Jewish law and custom. Rabbinic authority was derided as priestcraft, but you found Kohanim married divorcees, and women remarried without a get, and brothers married their widowed sisters-in-law. Later, this early 20th century already, New York passed a law, still on the books today, that cantors can perform weddings. What's the connection between cantors and weddings? Because cantors were performing weddings for money, and they lobbied to have themselves included in the statute that regulates the performance of weddings, even though the other religions only have their ministers. No, Jews have cantors also. But being a cantor does not make one an expert in Seder Kiddushin. Perhaps even worse, the democratic ethos that permeated American society influenced the Jews as well. And laymen felt that they were entitled to vote on halacha, much like the Knesset is trying to do today. Democracy produced a rejection of ultimate authority. So, for example, communities like Charleston, which for a long time into the 19th century was the largest Jewish community, was racked with controversy. And its main shul, Beit Elohim, eventually split into two and went into litigation in the first half of the 19th century over a vote to install an organ. The organ won, by the way, with an appellate judge asserting that he cannot decide ecclesiastical questions. So these reforms were always made in order to conform Judaism to modernity. In the specific instance of the organ, it's to conform Judaism to what the Christians were doing. In the appellate case, the pro-organ group in the temple stated, "We wish not to overthrow, but to rebuild, not to destroy, but to reform and revise the evils complained of." We wish to worship God not as slaves of bigotry and priestcraft, but as the enlightened descendants of that chosen race. Now note, this was way before the mass immigration of German Jews beginning in the 1840s that would stamp American Jewry with an Ashkenazic and Reform imprint. As is typical, the demand for changes came mostly from the younger generation. And with this, Reform took root in America, and Judaism forfeited its capacity to shape the world, or at least American society, in a Torah way. In the small rural towns to which many Jews had moved, religious observance like Shabbat Kashrut became impossible over the decades, and these Jews did not really survive. There's no yeshivot either. To some preachers, America was God's new Israel. There was a rabbi, Gustavus Poznanski, became the chazan and spiritual leader of Beit Elohim in Charleston in 1836. So he grew up in a frum home in Prussia, but he became decidedly less traditional over time. He advocated, besides the organ, he advocated for an end to Yom Tov Sheni. People would like him today also. He eventually resigned under pressure, but even he said at the dedication of a new shul building in 1841, I quote, "This synagogue is our temple. This city," he meant Charleston, "is our Jerusalem. This happy land, our Palestine. And as our fathers defended with their lives that temple, that city, and that land, so will their sons defend this temple, this city, and this land. America is our Zion, and Washington our Jerusalem." If you think about it, almost exactly a century later, there were Jews who were saying the same thing about Germany, as the Meshech Chochma famously quoted, with similar results, the latter in a physical sense, the former in a spiritual sense. So much energy then, 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, was expended fighting over doctrinal matters, belief in Mashiach, belief in God as creator, Shivat Zion, divine providence. And as Jews could not agree on what we believed, we became incapable of teaching others. And when the first rabbis did come in the 1840s, they were divided between Orthodox and Reform. So once again, there was no cohesion in the community, and that resulted in a muted religious sentiment. And because of the democratic ethos, rabbis were routinely fired, sometimes for taking traditional positions and sometimes for taking heretical positions. Rabbis can't win. So for example, Abraham Rice is credited with being the first ordained rabbi in America, the first Rav, Talmud of Rav Avram Bing in Germany. Rav Avram Bing was also the Rebbe of the Aruch Lanier, Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, Rebbe of the Chief Rabbi Nathan Adler of Britain. Rabbi Rice came in the 1840s. He was unwelcome in New York. So he moved to Baltimore. He led a shul. It was very traditional. Pro-Shmirat Shabbat, anti-intermarriage, even pro-Piyutim on the Chagim. But he was asked to leave after 9 years, 1849, because he refused to allow the performance of Masonic rites at funerals. So he left the rabbinate, eventually opened his own shul, but mainly he founded a dry goods store, and that sustained him until he died in 1871. On the other side of the spectrum, Reform Rabbi Isaac Meir Wise, who fancied himself America's leading rabbi, he published the first Seder in America, called it Minhag America. He was accused of rejecting Mashiach and violating Shabbat. The latter was probably false. The Shabbat was the only thing he kept. He rejected Talit, Tefillin, other things. He was fired by his temple in Albany. He was ordered not to show up. And when he did, on Rosh Hashanah of all times, the president, one Louis Spanier, punched him in the face. And a melee broke out, a brouhaha. Police came, arrests were made, Wise refused to press charges, and it was, as they say, Chil Hashem. So then, much like now, each shul did its own thing, and each community did its own thing. So of course the influence on the greater public would be absent. The other religions had hierarchies, like the Protestants had the presbyteries, and the Catholics would later have the dioceses and bishops and archbishops, cardinals, etc. Jews had nothing like that. And Jews even balked at having chief rabbis of cities the few times when that was proposed or implemented. So when the United States experienced its spiritual revivals, or called the Great Awakenings, especially in the 19th century, Jews were targets. Jews were not leaders of the Great Awakening. There were traditional leaders as well, like Isaac Leeser, but a strong moral voice was lacking. And this became obvious during the Civil War, when Jews fought for both the Union and the Confederacy. In fact, Gustavus Poznanski's son died in combat for the Confederates. There are accounts of Siddurim that took place during the war on both sides, and how soldiers were able to procure matzah and wine and haggadot and the like. Rabbis were very vocally on both sides of the slavery issue. There were Jewish slave owners in the South, relatively few, less than 1% of black slaves were owned by Jews. There were Jewish abolitionists in the North. Judah Benjamin was known as the brains of the Confederacy. See, he was known as a Jew, but he had long since intermarried and left the community. But he was clever enough to escape, unlike Jefferson Davis, clever enough to escape after the war ended, joining his family in France and then England, where he became a barrister. He was buried, and still is buried, in Paris in 1884, same cemetery as Frederick Chopin and Oscar Wilde and later Jim Morrison. But some of the Confederate statues that have been removed in recent years, say of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson, they were sculpted by Moses Ezekiel, who is a Confederate veteran. And Jews were horrified by General Grant's expulsion of Jews from his territory. Too many salesmen were running about, that they appealed to Lincoln, and the order was reversed within a few weeks. And Jews are always very quick to take action against anything perceived as anti-Jewish. David Urbanski was the first Jew awarded the Congressional Medal of Honor, bravery in the Battle of Shiloh, and then again at Vicksburg. Others say the first Jew to be awarded the Medal of Honor was Benjamin Levy of New York. Probably their mothers fought over who was first. So Levy was a private, as a drummer boy. He took the gun of a fallen soldier, went into battle, and when the colors were shot down, he saved them from capture. So he lived a long life. He died in 1921. If you read the sermons of the day, in the North, the Union victory was like Yetziat Mitzrayim, and Lincoln's assassination like Moshe's death on the threshold of the Promised Land. For the South, they compared it to the Churban. But Jews, by and large, were frightened during the Civil War, which is perhaps a reason why they generally took the side where they lived, but avoided being outspoken about it. There's a fear of instability, which has always been the bane of the exile. Rabbi Morris Rayfield of New York justified slavery. David Einhorn of Baltimore bitterly opposed it. Benjamin Jold, who was the father of Henrietta, he carefully avoided taking a position. But all Jews mourned Lincoln's death. Friday night, Shabbat Chol HaMoed, Pesach, in 1865, Einhorn compared him to Lincoln, but generally Jews referred to Lincoln, after he was killed, as Father Abraham. So Jews were trying to navigate the byways of a country that was new, with a political system that was unprecedented, and at the same time trying to preserve Judaism while also dealing with a growing reform movement that was rejecting basic tenets of Judaism and without strong rabbinic leadership. No wonder it was a balagan. The primary expression of Jewishness became through charitable and fraternal organizations. And that's true until today. If Jews were barred from joining some non-Jewish organizations, they did become Masons, and they also started their own groups, like B'nai B'rith, like the Odd Fellows. German Jews especially became prominent in philanthropy, often as a substitute for mitzvot. HIAS, the Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, was founded in 1881 to deal with Jewish immigrants, but it's no longer a Jewish organization. In fact, they just use the term HIAS now without spelling it out, because they deal almost entirely now with non-Jewish immigrants. They're a pro-open borders group. There's always a core that clung to Torah and mitzvot, even with great hardship. When the great wave of immigration changed American society, it also changed Jewish society. On the one hand, many organizations were created to cater to the religious population, like the Orthodox Union, 1898, and Young Israel, 1912. Yeshivot were opened. But on the other hand, part of the religious turmoil was the primacy of reform and their reckless dismissal of Torah, symbolized by the infamous Treif banquet celebrating the first graduating class of Hebrew Union College, which had been founded by Isaac Meir Wise in Cincinnati. The banquet took place July 11th, 1983. Ironic, I just read a few moments ago that they may be closing down. They may not have any ordainees. It's in decline. Anyway, that infamous Treif banquet is a lavish dinner that included clams, shrimp, frogs, meat, and milk mixed. Oddly, no pork. That was considered a step too far. Two rabbis walked out in horror. They invited rabbis from all over the country, other states, so as not to offend, but didn't eat. But most of the invited did eat. The Treif banquet had the unique distinction of ultimately spawning, in a way, both the Jewish Theological Seminary in 1886, which was founded originally as an Orthodox institution, and the OU. And interestingly, Henry Pereira Mendez was a founder of both. Imagine that today. Even as Reform rabbis mocked the criticism of the Treif banquet, deriding what they called stomach Judaism or kitchen Judaism. It also showed the complete democratization of American Jewish life that would only increase in the next century and a half. Ish hayosha be'einav yaseh, each person doing what he wants to do, each person is his own authority. And reform then, in the 1870s, 1880s, entered its heyday because there was no organized competition. And they set what would be the norms of Jewish life. No mechitza, no hoping for Mashiach, no Shivat Zion, no Hebrew prayers. In some places, no mikveh, no kol nidre. Many Jews still closed their stores on Shabbat, but Wise himself belittled Yom HaKippurim because he said concepts such as tshuvah, tefillah, repentance, prayer make no sense if we don't believe in a personal God who rewards and punishes. And until 1948, reform was doctrinally anti-Zionist and opposed to a Jewish state. So the current discomfort of reform rabbis with Israel is actually a reversion to their original opposition. The fact is, if you don't believe in the Bible, it's hard to believe there's any value in a Jewish state. So God became, in their words, the source of infinite love, and they would fill in the details. Some went off the rails completely, like the Ethical Culture Society, which is founded by Jews, founded in fact by the son of a Reform rabbi, denying God entirely and proposing human reason as the source of all morality. Well, that hasn't really worked out that well either. By the mid-19th century, half the American Jews were unaffiliated, and only a third were religious in any sense. And if you think that the Great Immigration induced Jews to abandon mitzvot, that's nostalgia. Note that in the 19th century, 250,000 European Jews converted to Christianity. The struggles then taking place in Europe were felt in America as well. Most Jews, especially in Western Europe, already had abandoned mitzvot, and Eastern European Jews were feeling the effects of the Haskalah. So most immigrants arrived in an atmosphere in which mitzvah observance was lax and there was no counterforce. And in truth, for all the pressures that generally existed, their religiosity was often a mile wide and an inch deep. The first generation was slightly more successful in remaining observant than when their children became Americanized. By the 1920s, 1930s, they were joining conservative and reformed temples that did not enjoin any deep connection to Torah. And the stereotype was accurate. Reform, the dominant movement for decades, was the least observant. Conservative Judaism, whose heyday was the 1950s and 60s, they occupied the middle ground, maintaining those aspects of tradition that accorded with a modern sensibility and jettisoning those that did not. The starting point of each movement, though, was a distorted relationship to Torah Sheba'al Peh. Reform rejected its authority completely, and the conservatives posited an evolving revelation in which the Torah and its mitzvot and customs could be updated with the times. They were emblematic of what one writer, almost a century and a half ago, already called cafeteria Judaism. You take what you want, and you ignore or discard the rest. The third group, the smallest, was the Orthodox, who strove to maintain the Masorah, observe the mitzvot, attend shuls with the mechitzot, keep the davening the same, and encourage the observance of Shabbat. And we know the first half of the last century, there were many self-defined Orthodox Jews who worked on Shabbat. That's how difficult it was. One example, the great philanthropist Harry Fischel came as a young immigrant in 1885, and he was told by relatives right away, throw away his yarmulke, and they mocked him when he failed to keep a job longer than a week. And then he decided to succumb. And one Shabbat, he went to Hashkama, where those who had to work davened, and he prepared to go to work afterward. And during davening, he changed his mind. And the rest is history. It doesn't happen to everyone, but 5 years later, he had already made his first million in real estate. There was early movement, even before the religious refugees arrived after the Holocaust. Eitz Chaim Yeshiva opened in 1886 in Lower Manhattan. It morphed into Reitz a decade later. Rabbi Dov Revel put on the map in 1915. A few years later, Torah Vadas opened. Torah Masor was founded in 1944 to establish day schools by the hundreds across the country. Kashrut became more specialized, more established, easier to observe. And Orthodoxy really strengthened even more in the 1930s when America moved to a five-day work week. And then by the great influx of Orthodox refugees after the Holocaust, which really spawned the revolution in Kashrut, Shabbat, and Talmud Torah as more yeshivot opened and Jewish education became more acceptable. But as yet, the numbers were really not there. To be sure, there were always Jewish parents who sacrificed every comfort to ensure that their children went to yeshiva. My own grandparents, Aleihem HaShalom, among them. But there weren't many. And retention of the young became a major concern. The Ritbaz, Rabbi Yaakov David Vilovsky of Slutsk, the Slutsk Rav, was a Rav in Chicago, and he fled Chicago in the early 1900s. I think by 1905 he was in Tzfat already, because he felt that compulsory education would enforce commingling of all cultures and the loss of Jewish identity. And he was quite negative. He wrote in his Hakdama to a Sefer, the very essence of the country precludes adherence to Torah. 2 points suffice. Jews as a people could not influence American religion because Judaism itself was in flux and uncertain of what it professed. And Jews were too fractured to speak with one voice, and regarding doctrine, agreed on very little. And if the Orthodox were certain, they were simply trying to keep their heads above water. And secondly, these movements were the gateways to assimilation, which is one reason why there were more American Jews 100 years ago than there are today. Over the decades, as non-Orthodoxy veered farther away from tradition, the compromises and reforms became more blatant until the last few decades. that conservatism differed from reform only in time by about a decade on women's issues and other matters, and the staggering rise of intermarriage in the 1970s provoked the addition of patrilineal descent in the 1980s as a source of Jewish identity. So this was based on necessity, not principle. So to date, the conservatives have held firm on that, and even as they begin to weaken somewhat on intermarriage and the rabbis attending or performing, they still do not accept patrilineal descent. By the 2000s, though, the decline in numbers was so pronounced that temples began to close and consolidate, and even some reform and conservative temples merged because the ideological differences evaporated, or at least were unclear to the layman. Today, the number of Jews in America is fudged because the surveys make no distinction between halachic and non-halachic Jews. It's estimated by them, by the Reform movement, that up to 50% of self-identified Reform Jews are not Jewish, kahalacha. The largest denomination is unaffiliated, just as it was in the middle of the 19th century. And you need no further proof of the fudge statistics than the fact that Orthodox Jews were 10% of Jews in 1970, and allegedly still 10% of Jews in 2020. So it's bogus. Either Orthodox Jews are being undercounted, which is undoubtedly true, and or many people are being counted who are not really Jewish, and that, of course, depresses the percentage of Orthodox Jews. If the surveys claim there are 7 million Jews in America today, so be it. I doubt there are even 4.5 million Jews in America. But what the most recent Pew survey does reveal is that Jews as a group are far less religious than Christians and Americans by every index. Jews are less likely to attend religious services weekly, only 12%. Versus 27% of all Americans. Less likely to believe in the God of the Bible. Only 26% of Jews believe in the God of the Bible versus 56% of all Americans and 80% of Christians. Only 21% of Jews say that religion is very important to them versus 41% of Americans and 57% of Christians. Orthodox Jews are, of course, the great exception, and the intensity of our beliefs is on a par, according to the surveys, with white evangelicals. What the Reform dominance in the 19th and early 20th centuries achieved was the ethnicization of Jewish life. Judaism primarily as an ethnic identity and less as a religion that has commandments and a lifestyle and a value system and a global purpose. So as such, we fail to have any real positive effect on the great moral and spiritual issues of the day. Jewish values are just conflated with Christian or mostly liberal values without giving any thought to it. On a personal note, that's why I was one of the founders of the Coalition for Jewish Values about 5 years ago. Now I serve as their Israel Region Vice President, because the realization that there was no rabbinic public policy organization that would articulate the Torah viewpoint on issues. What are the authentic Jewish values? So whenever a question arose, the media would seek out Reform spokesmen who are mostly in line with the Democrats' platform, but hundreds of miles away from an authentic Torah view. So now we're routinely quoted in the media, sometimes alone, more often as a counterpoint to the Reform who really resent our existence. To give one illustration of the problem, the Reform embrace of abortion on demand without limitation and as an act of religious worship as a sacrament is, of course, far removed from Jewish values. To give another, the Orthodox organizations are mostly focused on parochial issues like tuition tax credits and security for Jewish institutions and the like. Torah was replaced by tikkun olam, this notion of repairing the world, which of course omitted the kicker, l'taken olam machut shakai, under God's kingdom. That is, what will further God's agenda for the world of morality and holiness? What will promote the ethical idea of God? On that score, the tikkun olam crowd is not only absent, but also completely distort the Torah view to advance an immoral, anti-Torah, often anti-Jewish agenda, hiding under the words tikkun olam. It's a synonym for social justice, unlimited immigration, welfare, abortion, gun control, free love, even socialism in some contexts, and of course philanthropy, which is a Jewish value. So this nicely segues into the topic of Jews and politics, on which we had some but limited influence. Granted, for more than a century, American Jews were first acclimating themselves to this unprecedented polity, a nation that would welcome Jews with equal rights and freedom of worship. So there are glitches, to be sure. Note that the First Amendment explicitly reads, "Congress shall make no law." Be quite a while until these freedoms apply to the states. So, for example, colonial times, to be a member of the Pennsylvania legislature, one had to acknowledge, I quote, "the scripture of the Old and New Testaments." Jews protested. It would be many decades before that was repealed. Maryland similarly required explicitly allegiance to Christianity. Literally, I quote, "a declaration of a belief in the Christian religion," end quote, in order to hold public office. This was not repealed until 1826 in what was known informally and indelicately as the Jew Bill, but technically as an act to extend to the sect of people professing the Jewish religion the same rights and privileges enjoyed by Christians. And similarly, Jews were bedeviled by the blue laws in many states that prohibited commerce on Sundays, and thus for Jews, untenable loss of 2 days of business because of Shabbat. So these would not be repealed for almost a century and a half that still exists in Bergen County, as many of the listeners know. In Charleston, South Carolina, Jews sold their merchandise on Friday to blacks who sold it on Shabbat, which infuriated the Southerners, the sale to blacks, not the sale of the merchandise. It was a clever, if not entirely halachic, gambit. Jews for a long time did not seek political office. Thomas Sowell, the great economist, pointed this out in one of his books, that in reference to the black obsession with having black politicians lead them, like in Detroit, Chicago, Baltimore, Newark, etc., since the 1960s, where they just ran their cities into the ground. So Saul says he uses Jews as an example of a people that became established in America without having real political representation, but Jews focused on education and business and networking. Indeed, New York City for most of the 20th century was 25% Jewish and didn't have a Jewish mayor until Ed Koch. Although insiders know that Fiorello LaGuardia, his mother was Jewish, so he was a Jew. In fact, he spoke fluent Yiddish. He didn't identify as a Jew, though. Sowell maintains that the Irish made the same mistake that the blacks did, but they learned their lesson 60, 70 years ago. It's not about the representative in power who does favors for you. That's not how you build a community. Yeah, there were Jewish senators in the 19th century, but usually had converted to Christianity already, like David Levy Yulee of Louisiana, or they were intermarried and estranged, like Judah Benjamin. There wasn't a Jewish cabinet secretary until Teddy Roosevelt's time. Oscar Strauss was the brother of Isidore Nathan, the founders of Macy's. So Isidore died in the Titanic, but Nathan, of course, did not board the Titanic, but diverted, went to Israel instead, bought land, and Netanya is named after him. Politics were not a priority for Jews. Even Jews who became close advisors to politicians often did not do anything for Jews. And worse, Jews were enamored with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who surrounded himself with Jewish advisors, almost all of whom did nothing to pressure him during the Holocaust. One late exception was the Treasury Secretary, Henry Morgenthau Jr. One great failure was the Reform Rabbi, Stephen Wise. For example, when the famous Rabbis' March on Washington took place, 400 rabbis, October 6, 1943, the day before Erev Pesach, his speechwriter Sam Roseman and the Reform Rabbi Wise told him not to meet them. They stood outside the White House, and Roosevelt was in the White House. Don't meet them, they're not representative of the Jewish community, they're old school. So Jews had access, but no influence and no power. And yet, as the Jewish expression of the time went, the Jews have three worlds, Dreivelten, Dievelt, this world, Yenevelt, the next world, and Roosevelt. It was FDR who changed political life in America for Jews and blacks. Until FDR, Jews and blacks were mainly voted Republican. So what changed? There are a few reasons. 1920 was the last time more Jews voted for Republican than any other candidate. 43% of Jews voted for Warren Harding, of all people. But 38% voted for Eugene V. Debs, the socialist. Jews were enthralled by socialism, and FDR was perceived as, even accused of, having socialist leanings. Secondly, the Republican majority began restricting immigration in the 1920s, and that antagonized Jews who were by then mostly recent immigrants. By 1928, 72% of Jews voted for Al Smith over Herbert Hoover, and that number has remained consistent since then. Only Democrat to receive less than 50% of the Jewish vote since then was the anti-Israel Jimmy Carter in 1980, and even he got 45% to Reagan's 39%. Third, the Democrats were perceived as more open to the groups that were not part of the establishment, like Jews and Catholics and blacks. And FDR, for the first time in presidential politics, built a coalition of groups. He added farmers, wanted to attract different blocks of voters, and that still exists today to an incredibly refined degree. And fourth, Democrats became associated with a more open, liberal, progressive, and secular policies. Jews began to be passionate about eradicating any mention of religion in the public domain, becoming leaders in the ACLU and campaigning for the abolition of prayer in public school, any teaching of values, even having the Ten Commandments hang in courthouses. So this was an era in which the main identity of Jews was as non-Christians. So anything that touched on religion, even a silent prayer in school, even a coach praying privately after a game, which is in litigation now, was held somehow to be a threat to the viability of Jewish religious life. Actually, what was the threat? The threat was the elimination of all religious ideas and values from public life. And that's produced now three generations of values-free children who, among other things, can't agree on who's a boy and who's a girl. I've always found this fixation with the Democratic Party to be unhealthy for Jews. It was Milton Himmelfarb who remarked almost 60 years ago that Jews earn like Episcopalians but vote like Puerto Ricans. He meant that Jews had the education and prosperity of American Episcopalians who overwhelmingly voted for Republicans, but they voted like Puerto Ricans, who are usually less wealthy and less well-educated Jews, and who voted for Democrats. I wish that American Jews would be split 50-50, and thereby really retain some influence in the parties. But now the Jewish vote is taken for granted, just like the black vote is. It's not widely discussed, but many people realize that American Jews do not vote based on a candidate's views towards Israel, but on a candidate's views towards abortion and other social issues. A Democrat can't be anti-Israel, but merely has to mouth certain platitudes about Israel to be accepted. The 1970s, 1980s saw the rise of neoconservatism, which was largely but not entirely composed of Jews who were liberals who had been mugged by reality. They were traditional, favored a muscular foreign policy, free markets, and have fallen into hard times in recent years as a result of the wars of the last two decades. They might be making a comeback pretty soon. Ronald Reagan was heavily influenced by them. People like Irving Kristol, Norman Panhar, Gene Kirkpatrick, and others. It was a Jewish nuance in politics. The rule of thumb these days is that the more traditional a person is, the more likely he is to vote for the Republican. And so Orthodox Jews today are about 60% Republican. Trump, as he's well aware, received in the last election about 60% of the Orthodox vote. But Jewish money continues to flow into Democratic coffers, even with a declining influence on Democratic policies. The Jewish vote is rarely dispositive today because Jews are concentrated in Democratic states. but Jewish money remains influential, although generally given unthinkingly, because the Republican alternative is considered unthinkable. The ambivalence, some would say confusion, in American Jewish politics is visible in the response to the civil rights movement. So here Jews did make a difference and were good influences on society. Among the founders in 1909 of the NAACP, literally marching with blacks for equal rights, literally getting killed, trying to register them to vote in Mississippi, as were Goodman and Schwerner in 1964, young Jews that summer comprised half the civil rights workers in Mississippi. Reform movement was heavily involved. Jews were close allies of Martin Luther King, and he reciprocated, memorably supporting Israel during the Six-Day War, signing an ad in the New York Times and arguing something we live with today. I quote him, "When people criticize Zionists, they mean Jews. You're talking anti-Semitism." A Reform rabbi from Newark, Joachim Prinz, spoke at the famous March on Washington, August 28, 1963, the King, I Have a Dream speech, and Prinz said, "Our ancient history began with slavery and yearning for freedom. It is for these reasons that it is not merely sympathy and compassion for the black people of America that motivates us. It is above all and beyond all such sympathies and emotions, a sense of complete identification, solidarity, born of our own painful historic experience." But this support, more on the surface, than it was sincere, has not turned out well, and it foundered on the key principle on which modern black activists have totally repudiated Martin Luther King, the notion that society should guarantee not just equal opportunity, but equal results. And with that, King's dream, I looked to a day when people will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Well, that day has passed and never came, and modern America judges everyone by superficial characteristics, as in Biden's really racist, sexist promise to nominate a black woman for Supreme Court justice, which obviously took me out of the running. It's hard to imagine a Jew being nominated again. The Democrats must nominate a minority, and the Republicans can't find a Jewish legal conservative. With the rise of affirmative action in the 1970s, preceded by the school board fights in New York City in the late 60s, when the demand was made for more black administrators and fewer Jews, so the Jews were now caught in a quandary. They perceived blacks as natural allies because we'd both been victims of persecution. But with affirmative action, those interests diverged. Jews, in the beginning, we helped ourselves. We didn't seek help from government. So the first to suffer from affirmative action were Jews, who are overrepresented in colleges, law, medical schools, business, etc. It's gotten so bad these days, I just heard a few days ago, there are law firms, investment banking companies that will not even interview white Jews because they need to fill certain diversity quotas. Those who keep speaking of restoring the original alliance are oblivious to the fact that our policies on key issues are no longer the same. And most black activists today are relentlessly anti-Israel, another point of departure from the past. Not all, but most. One of the few politicians that presented as faithful to Jewish values, not that I agree with every word that he said, or did, was Joe Lieberman. It wasn't just that he was observant. He was more conscious of what Jewish values are and always tried to act in the spirit of Jewish morality, not least when he publicly chastised Bill Clinton for his indiscretions, even though he voted against impeachment. But in this golden age of orthodoxy, the last 20 years, it's been common to see religious Jews in every part of civic life. And it's been spearheaded, no doubt, by the existence of Yeshiva University and Turo and the explosion of yeshivot across the land and the integration of Jews into public life. Aside from this, Jews were in the forefront of removing religion from the public square, both through the ACLU and through the alphabet soup of Jewish organizations. Historically, Americans were comfortable with religion in public, FDR's address to the nation on D-Day reads like a sermon. Before World War II, it was not even an issue. By the 1950s, Jews started protesting prayer in public schools, religious expressions like creches and tablets, luchot in public spaces, and became free speech absolutists, which engendered the proliferation of pornography. It was a big change. Irving Kristol once wrote that in his Brooklyn public schools, an equal balance of Jews and Christians, the principal began every day with a psalm. Nobody would object. I quote, "It was a common sense solution to a problem. It worked for many, many decades." End quote. That is, until we develop this obsessive fear of Christianity that sought to eradicate any public expression of religion. And the result is clear. When that happened, 10 years later, intermarriage ballooned from 9% in 1965 to 70% today. It's not the only cause, but I think it's a powerful cause. Whatever else it accomplished, it struck God and values from the curriculum and helped turn Jews disproportionately into atheists and agnostics who would have no formal connection to Jewish life. American Jews, outside of Reform officially, were helpful in steering American support for the establishment of the State of Israel. And from 1948 to 67, American Jews were almost entirely supportive of Israel. Certainly in the wake of the Holocaust, it made it easier to form the Conference of Presidents, which was done at the request of John Foster Dulles, because he was tired of meeting with a plethora of Jewish groups individually. Change came with the Six-Day War, when Israel ceased being a victim and the first fissures developed. Jews became pro-Arab. Jews met with Arafat. Jews supported a Palestinian state. Jews were uncomfortable with the right wing and the more religiously traditional governments that were formed in Israel. Non-Orthodox Jews protested the attempt to conform the law of return to halacha in 1970. They still do. But even as their numbers and influence in American society has dwindled, they've responded by making even more demands in Israel for official recognition and funding and a place of the Kotel and the secularization of Israeli life. And these struggles are on our plate today. So in conclusion, rather than influence the society, rather than proclaim the values of ethical monotheism and encourage adherence to the Noahide laws, plus Jews were influenced, and Judaism adapted itself to the new environment by discarding some mitzvot and ikarim and incorporating American ideas and values and calling that Judaism. It was as if Jews felt that the only way to secure full civil equality was by curtailing those aspects of Judaism that made us different, unique, and Jewish. It's a story of upward mobility, but materially, not spiritually. And intermarriage, as we know, is devastating Jewish life. Someone said a few decades ago that in America, the problem is not that they want to kill us, but that they want to marry us. And I always say that when there's no idea of what the Torah is and what the Torah asks of us, then not to intermarry is just racist or jingoistic. And therefore, it's understandable on that level, but it's unconscionable from a Jewish perspective. Jews have gained widespread acceptance in America, even as they have an outsized fear of Jew hatred. In America, interestingly enough, by the polls, 77% of people would vote for a Jewish president, the highest of any ethnic group. And Jews have been instrumental in propelling the secularization of society at great cost. Like Kristol said, before World War II, no one cared about carols in schools, and no Jew became a Christian as a result. There's so many organizations, Jewish organizations, fighting Jew hatred. How many organizations are trying to explain to Jews why be Jewish? And worse, there's a fragmentation of Jewish life. Young Jews are dropping out of the non-Orthodox movement. Worse than that, only 9% of Orthodox Jews in America, based on the polls, feel they have a lot in common with Reform and Conservative Jews, and vice versa. More than half feel, 49% of Orthodox Jews, 60% of Reform Jews feel they have nothing in common with the other. Jews are less than 2% of the population and are overrepresented, just like in law and entertainment and business, in politics as representatives, as senators, as cabinet secretaries. Jews have been fully integrated in American life, but at what cost? It's as if God has tested us, in essence saying, for 19 centuries, you had to serve me amid persecution and insecurity and inequality. You're always vulnerable. So I'll give you the opportunity in a malchut shel chesed to serve me in freedom and liberty, in dignity and equality. Let's see if persecution was a rationalization or there's a bigger problem. As always, Jews can go one of two ways. Jews can continue on the path to assimilation and disappearance, or of redefining Judaism that stands for everything and nothing, and strip true Jewish identity of any meaning. I mean, Pew reports that for more than 40% of Jews, the defining aspects of their Judaism is that they like the food or they like the jokes. That's one way. Or there's another way of tshuva, of repentance, of bringing back more and more Jewish souls to God's service and taking advantage of the land of freedom and opportunity to build more Torah into their lives and then actualize the next stage in Jewish life, the return to Tzion. If anything, the American Jewish experience in politics and religion has taught us that the compromises proffered by the conservatives more than a century ago, that you need to modernize the Torah to be part of society, that's been disproven. You could be part of society and be a full shomer mitzvot. You just can't fulfill every desire. You have to live a disciplined life in an undisciplined society. So we've seen how Orthodox Jews can achieve every position in society and retain their faith. And we have seen, important for Israel, how Haredim can learn and work and also be part of society and do not need total segregation. Well, even in America, that's changing now. But America was a gift to the Jewish people. As we began this series, we quote Chaim Volozhin, who stated that prophesied that America would be the last outpost of Torah, the last refuge before the redemption came. May we merit doing what we can to save the Sheret HaPleita and together behold the end of exile and the coming of Mashiach b'mehera b'yameinu. Amen. I thank you all for your participation. Thank you all for attending.